Hello, everyone. Welcome to ConV2X. Today, we're going to talk about the next generation of telehealth. And I've got a great group of experts here with me. So my job is going to try and extract as much out of their insightful brains as I possibly can to help you understand what's going on in the marketplace. Let's start with introductions. Cheyenne, why don't we go with you first, if that's okay?
Thanks for joining us today. My name's Cheyenne Bias. I'm a practicing intensivist. I've practiced telehealth for over 20 years. I previously led Teladoc Health and helped manage over 20 million telehealth visits across the country, as well as 25,000 physicians. I'm now at Hippocratic AI, a generative AI company, and I'm EVP of clinical strategy and business development.
And we've got generative AI in the conversation straight away. Look at that. Greg, over to you, sir.
Sure. Greg Caressi, Senior Vice President, Partner at Frost & Sullivan. I'm the currently serving as America's regional leader and the Chief Customer Engagement Officer. Look forward to working with everybody and talking today.
Super. Thank you. Bill, over to you.
Thanks, Ritesh. Thanks for having me here. Bill Farah, Principal with Deloitte. Started out as a primary care physician at UPMC. Actually left practice to work for the CIO at UPMC to stand up and lead an interoperability program as well as a telehealth program and enterprise analytics. So turns out those problems are really hard to solve. So I went into consulting in 2010 and been working on those problems ever since. So great to be with this group today.
Great. Thank you for joining us. And last but not least, Sarah, good
Hey,
morning to
thanks,
you.
y'all.
How are you?
Good morning. Yes. So, Sarah Bell, I'm a nurse. Spent over 18 years of my career at Mayo Clinic, the last 10 years in virtual care, starting EICU, and doing virtual nursing, post-acute RPM hospital at home. Currently in the Gen AI space as well as a chief clinical officer. So I'm excited to be here with all of you.
Well, why don't we stay with you, Sarah, to start with? Telehealth, we've been talking about it and listening about it for maybe 20 years, but it really boomed during the pandemic. Where are we today, do you think? Is it in use most of the time, all of the time? What would you say?
It's a really good question. So I think telehealth, correct. COVID started and we saw a boom in telehealth usage, whether it's the inception of virtual nursing, which was a necessary practice to help support our nurses. I think hospital at home had a huge boom and push from COVID as we look at capacity issues in the hospital and staffing issues. I think where we're at today is kind of at a precipice because we don't have staffing resources nationally, and it's getting harder and harder for healthcare institutions to support moving staff out of seeing physical patients into virtual care. And I think also we're at a point of reimbursement models maybe not matching where we need to be. So hospital home as an example is typically seen at some of the major medical centers and isn't hitting rural America because it's expensive. And I think rural America right now is suffering in terms of, hospitals, healthcare institutions closing and needing more support from virtual care. So I think we're at a really important inflection point, and we need to kind of figure out how to make care more efficient. How do we allow practitioners to be more efficient rather than just having people, as part of the problem? So that's my take today.
So I'm assuming, I mean, Cheyenne, the technology has been there for a while. I mean, you were a Teladoc, right? I mean, is it an infrastructure issue or a people issue? What do you think?
So I think this conversation is drastically different now that we're on the other side of that really bad viral infection. To Sarah's point, 10 years ago, we were probably talking about how to build a telehealth program from the ground up, how to get key stakeholders involved, how to address legislation or payment issues. I think we're on the other side of this. Look, telehealth is adopted worldwide now. You don't need a platform. I think you need to incorporate it into the front lines workforce, right? Workflow, excuse me. Allow them to practice telehealth where it's convenient and easy. It doesn't need to be a super big platform that's proprietary anymore. All the EMRs now have essentially APIs that allow you to bring in video conferencing. Video conferencing is now HIPAA compliant if you do it the right way. So I think this is no longer about the technology. I think to Sarah's point, she said, how do we make care more efficient? And How do we allow providers to be more effective? And I think, look, there's AI in healthcare. You know, that's helping with daily automated tasks. We don't need to type in everything anymore, right? That's really good. I think, though, the challenge is that I would argue that we don't need physicians and nurses to doing everything. We don't need providers doing everything. We do want patients to be connected. We do want patients to be provided care from our hospitals and our practices. And that's where I really think generative AI is going to come forward. We can deploy hospital and home around this country easily and safely when we use artificial intelligence, specifically helping with the guardrails around patient care and being able to check on them. I think the key part of generative AI or artificial intelligence in healthcare is keeping the human in the loop. We can't allow the AI to go autonomous completely. And we need to build it with guardrails around clinicians like Sarah and the Mayo Clinic and others like the UPMC. I think it needs to be within the stable of tools that we have.
So, Bill, you know, you've been consulting for a lot of clients. Are you seeing a shift? Because we know the promise is there, infrastructure's there, but where are you on the ground with some of these big institutions? Are they adopting it or moving away from it?
Yeah, I think Sarah hit the nail on the head, not surprisingly. I mean, it's really about workflow,
Gotcha.
workflow, workflow. As Cheyenne said, it's not a technology problem anymore. I have to say, I'm a little disappointed at some of the retrenchment that has occurred since the pandemic. I think we were really heading in the right direction during the pandemic. I was hoping that momentum would continue and we'd continue to go in the direction that we were. To Cheyenne's point, I mean, we have so many access problems in this country still. And I thought we were on the verge of really making meaningful progress in solving those. I do think people are struggling with the workflow. How do we create virtual waiting rooms? How do we create virtual workforce? How do we complement that workforce, as Cheyenne was starting to allude to, with virtual agents? We're closer than we ever were. We've made a ton of progress. I think people are just catching their breath, and then we're going to take another run at this. I think we're much further than we were, as everyone has said, than we were 4 years ago.
And Greg, you know, from a policy perspective, a lot of this, particularly Sarah, you mentioned the rural health stuff. One of the issues is infrastructure. I mean, there are places where you can't even get signal as opposed, you know, even 3G. Are you seeing any policy changes, Greg, or anywhere where these things will help with the infrastructure bill passing with lots of money going to states to create these things?
Yeah, I think, you know, if we're talking about access,
Yeah.
obviously access to telecommunications infrastructure is a key part if we're referring to virtual visits. And I would like to expand the idea of telehealth beyond virtual visits, right? Because I think one of the challenges we have at this point with telehealth overall is we have the technology, we don't have the strategy refined to really scale it up. And I think that's the gap that we need to address, is how do we scale telehealth to really address things like access, cost, and all the other issues that were raised. And that includes things like store and forward, right? If you're going to deal with chronic condition patients, contacting them on a more regular basis via store and forward, which doesn't require large bandwidth, allows you to get regular information and determine who do I need to have a virtual visit with. It takes less clinician time, and it goes into, you know, being able to have information without the cost of the human end. You can apply AI tools to evaluate some of the feedback and determine, okay, these are the people I need to have virtual visits with. So I think the issues that we have are probably not as much infrastructure, even in terms of infrastructure in rural areas, although that is still a challenge. It's also from the business case side within the provider end of saying, how do I apply telehealth and the different tools I have in telehealth to really scale this up and get more benefit to the system, to the individual, to the cost of healthcare?
You know, it's really, really fascinating you say that, because sometimes I think about maybe we should rebrand this thing, telehealth. We should call it something different because it encompasses so many new nuances, as Cheyenne has pointed out. And thanks, Lyle Berkowitz, for joining us. How are you this morning, sir?
Hey, great.
Good. Quick introductions from you, please, and then we can have you give us your opinion and thought from what you've just heard.
Some thoughts, I have some reflections already. Lyle
Excellent.
Berkowitz. So I'm a primary care physician. who spent many years at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago, both as a clinician, but also as a health system executive, overseeing a lot of IT and innovation, particularly around primary care. So things like telehealth and population health were often under my domain. I also spent a lot of time in the digital health landscape as anywhere from an advisor to investor to founder to CEO at a variety of digital health companies. I spent 2+ years helping lead one of the larger telehealth companies in the nation as chief medical officer and EVP of product. Currently, I am the CEO and founder of a group called KeyCare, which is a national virtual care practice that works on Epic and specifically is designed to align with other Epic sites to supply additional virtualists in a tech-enabled fashion. So I'm speaking to some of what was brought up earlier by Bill and others, I absolutely believe that there's a plenty of demand for virtual care, but the supply is low because the office-based doctors, the health system and other doctors, I'll call them officeologists, right? They are optimized around office-based care, just like we have hospitalists in the 90s. I believe we need a new form of doctors, virtualists, who are more optimized around virtual care. We can't just ask our office-based doctors to intermittently do some virtual care here and there. This is a new type of specialty that's forming. And to Greg's point, I actually published with a couple of folks a couple of years ago, including John Halamka, something in Telehealth and Medicine Today, defining virtual care as sort of a larger term that includes telehealth, the traditional video or asynchronous, includes autonomous care, et cetera, that I do believe telehealth alone is clearly more of the synchronous, maybe asynchronous type of care, but virtual care as umbrella term could include everything, including autonomous types of care, anything that we can do that take care of the patient outside of the office.
But surely, Sarah, that would need to rethink a workflow process, right? Because if we encompass the things that I've just heard about, you could have a visit via a video, you could have an AI bot reach out to a patient who's newly discharged just to check in, and if they respond, then you can do something. So there are some nuances with the way we could do this. Are we seeing changes in workflow? Are people thinking about that to say, is there another way to do this, to Lyle's point?
Yeah, I think so. And Lyle brings up a good point. So virtual care is a specialty, and we're moving into that concept that if you have, we know that, you know, there's critical care specialists, there's cardiologists, there's oncologists. So we know that when we specialize in certain areas of care, what happens? People become more efficient in the way they can care for patients. They can do it with an expertise that provides better care than somebody who's just generally kind of stopping by to do virtual care as part of their day. And so moving into the specialty space and recognizing virtual care as that specialty, does require a change in workflow, and a really positive change in workflow. So we can't have clinicians doing part of their care virtually and the other in person. It's dissatisfying to them. They're not good at it. They're juggling, and they have to pay attention to the in-person patients first, as they should. And so the virtual care patients get left off.
He's just chomping on the bit.
Yeah. Come on.
I think what Lyle's doing is great because it offers that ability for the health system to leverage a network, right? That's already existing, and likely allows that health system, that network, to be charged under that same charge for telehealth. I think that's really great. It keeps the continuity simple and it keeps it within the system. But virtual care is not a specialty. I don't need a specialty service every time I open up a new clinic. Or if I change the way that you walk into my front door, either through the hospital or through the ICU on a ventilator or through the ER as a trauma patient or through an ambulance or through an ambulatory surgical center. I don't need all these different specialties. Telehealth is part of care. We can just drop the tele part and it's still healthcare. I think physicians, nurses, I think they need to have better training from day one. They need to learn how to incorporate telehealth into their practice. But let's not go too far. Virtual care is not a specialty. Virtual care or telemedicine is part of healthcare.
Saying hospitalists aren't a specialty. Yeah. That's not fair. I don't agree with your assumption there. I do agree that all doctors may need to do some telehealth. But your argument would suggest that hospitalists should not be a specialty, and it is a specialty for what they do. It doesn't mean that a cardiologist can't do hospital care, etc. But that I think we have to be careful on how we overplay that discussion.
Certain organizations did try to, start a group that was just focused on telehealth because they saw different characteristics needed to interface with patients that way.
My argument is I think the training needs to start on day one. Now, if you become a specialist, like a hospitalist, or you go into intensive care, that's a different thing. But I think the reality is from day one, nursing school, medical school, we need to incorporate these technologies. Look, my children and many of your grandchildren, they're using these technologies every day in their everyday lives. Nobody is going to the bank to deposit a check. These are realities of technology. We need to incorporate all these technologies into our practice and into our training. That's my point. We don't need to
do this. Hang on, guys. So let me go to Bill first and then Sarah, you after that. And by the way, a discussion, not an argument, yes. I would say. Cheyenne's making an interesting point. So Bill, off you go.
I love the passion. It's
great.
I think as Sarah started to talk about, we have had such a difficult time reimagining the way that we take care of patients, starting with the introduction of electronic medical records. And we have still been paper-based in our way of thinking, location-based in the way that we think. I think we are on the verge of a true digital transformation. I'll throw another a catchword out there to go with virtual, but digital, because I do think that, as Greg said, there's different techniques, right? This is no longer a technology conversation. It's a technique conversation. How do we reimagine from start to finish the way that we take care of people or help them be healthy? And we have all of these things at our disposal, yet we so far have fallen back on traditional models and traditional ways of thinking. And so we're going to continue to push people to rethink, reimagine the way that we take care of people, rethink workflows, incorporation of virtual care with in-person care, with monitoring,
remote care,
as Craig was talking about, and home care. So it's very much a work in progress. And I think that, luckily the people in this conference are right at the forefront of that.
Yeah. So I was at a CIO conference of hospital CIOs last month, and the CIO from Mount Sinai, she's now at Northwell, statement was, we are living in a 24/7 world as consumers, but in healthcare, we're still 9 to 5. Right. So even she's sort of recognizing that there's some shift that has to occur. Can it be done maybe in different ways? So to Lyle and what he's doing, can you do it for, let's say, primary care first and then go into some of the other specialists like oncologists and cardiology, et cetera? Or to Shine's point, it's just everywhere now. Sarah, you were going to say something earlier. I cut you off.
Yeah, I think it's a workflow thing. So yeah. I don't disagree that people coming out of college today are likely better suited for the technological advancements that we have going on today than most clinicians who've been doing it for 20 years. But I think there's an expertise that has to be behind the camera. And that expertise is not given from day one as a clinical person. So you need to get into practice and develop your critical thinking skills and develop some of that. Because I think the expectation is that the person behind the camera has a level of expertise, especially in virtual care and in, providing services remotely. There is a difference in how you're providing that care. And so it's a workflow adoption piece, and going practice by practice is just the way we have to go about it. It's the way that it is. Adoption can be low if we don't have the implementation resources that people need to do well. And just one other point, during my time at Mayo, during the pandemic, we went full dedicated on telehealth, and we saw having that dedication, we saw a tremendous increase in their ability to be efficient and actually care for more patients. Because you get more, if you're doing similar things every day, whether it's in-person care or virtual care, you're going to become more efficient in how to do that. And so I think that's an important piece to how we're delivering these services too.
Great. Well, I would jump. Yeah, sorry. I would jump on that.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, and say, on. You know, that as an organization, how can we become more efficient, right? Because there's different goals of telehealth, right? During the pandemic, one of the things we did with telehealth and chatbots was screen patients, right? To do some initial triaging. And sometimes that's what patients want. It doesn't even have to include a video. It could be, you know, some of that was done on a computer, phone lines. You talk to a nurse, hey, my kid has these conditions. Do I need to take time off work to come in? From the consumer's perspective, there's an efficiency in not saying I have to set a time for a virtual visit. I can call up the nurse line and get advice and, you know, make my decision and go to the next step as needed. So, you know, there's organizational efficiency. And part of that is segmenting patients, right? We don't really do a good job of segmenting patients when we're funneling them all into virtual visits, right? We're saying, what are these patients coming for? What are their goals? What are our goals and things we need to do as an organization? And how can we devise our telehealth strategy, taking those, all those variables in mind, not just, hey, I need virtual visits.
So if you're watching this, you know, if people are watching this, one of the things that's coming through loud and clear is that we've got to look at the entire workflow and not just do it in silos, right? That seems to be one of the big things going on.
Yep.
Dr. Lyle, you picked on Epic as your partner. Why?
A couple obvious reasons. One, you know, they are, you could argue, the operating system of healthcare. Over 60% of healthcare systems are using them. People are used to it. It's a full electronic medical record. I'd been in the other side. Most of the large telehealth vendors, what I'll call the telehealth 1.0 vendors, have spent 20 years building their own technology. One, they're not even electronic medical records, you know, meaningful use certified records. They're very basic documentation and video types of software. Two, they are not well adopted, integrated into the healthcare system. They don't use standard, you know, the data models that are easily shared. And you know, three, they are very expensive. To build your own EMR today, to keep up, even try and keep up, is very expensive. So I was able to get, you know, a system that was fully adopted or well adopted. It was very powerful. And because we're sort of renting it, we're clients of Epic. Yeah, it is less expensive than building it from scratch. And now I've got, 10,000 people in, you know, Madison building new tools constantly to make it better. And this goes to the point, and I'm agreeing with Cheyenne on this, right? This is still has to be great care. It's not, you shouldn't take care of telehealth patients on a different type of technology. It needs to be a full electronic medical record. And so now we've got better, faster, cheaper, more integrated technology to work with. And the big difference is that during COVID, Epic spent a lot of time and money to build up their telehealth ability, which made it easier for us to not only have a great EMR, but also have telehealth software that could handle both scheduled and on-demand care. And so,
that's the big thing. The reason is it makes it easier for the physician or the nurse practitioner to be integrated. And so you could choose in-office visit or telehealth visit or schedule a visit. Is that the reason? Is it easier for the physician, or is it easier for billing or chart notes? What's the issue?
It's better for the patients, more integrated. So the patient can go to their health system. And that uses Epic, and Epic has developed not just data interoperability, which is hugely important because the physician has more information, they share it, but also workflow interoperability. So they have the ability to go into the health system Epic instance and then immediately connect into our Epic instance. So to the patient, it's more seamless.
Gotcha.
And potentially more importantly is because we have the data on the patient, we can make a better decision. even if it's for a minor issue, having all that data helps us make a better decision.
So you have access to the chart itself. You have access to the full
Epic's,
chart.
Yeah, Epic has Care Everywhere, which is their internal interoperability features that allows us to have every piece of data about the patient, make a better decision, and send it back. So we're now sharing it fully with the internal medicine or primary care doctor, and we're able to do more than urgent care, right?
Gotcha.
Every other telehealth 1.0 company can do transactional one-off care. We're able to do longitudinal, more robust care. To the point about 24/7, I'll add, we do on-demand 24/7 urgent care. I don't think we're going to have a world where necessarily we're going to have specialists on 24/7, but should we be able to handle, whether by bots, by urgent care, who can help triage a patient? Absolutely. I've been on many cases where I've seen, you know, a patient may come in late at night, and what they need to know is, do I have to go to the ER tonight? Can I wait till tomorrow to see my primary or go to urgent care versus emergency care? And that type of triage becomes really important as well. And since I have the form, I'm going to add one more thing. It's a lot of questions.
Because I'm going to go to Cheyenne next anyway. So.
And I'm going to ask everyone to think about this. I think our biggest issue is not technology, not workflow. It is financial incentives. Once we get financial incentives more aligned, everything else will be a lot easier. Because really what we're talking about is not necessarily just virtual care, but it's a form of population health, team-based care, sharing of patients, et cetera. And on all that, what we've got is way too often an RVU-based system that pays doctors for volume in the office. And why should they do telehealth where they often have to have lower codes or share their care with another a virtualist sort of partner? It doesn't make sense. We have to rethink compensation design, even outside of value-based care, et cetera. How a health system pays its doctors will be very much aligned with how well telehealth does. Mayo, for example, pays by salary, so much more aligned to doing telehealth than a place that pays their doctors just by our views. Okay, I threw out a lot for you.
Yeah, thank you, though. The regulatory one is the one I was going to go to next. But Cheyenne, give us your thoughts based on your experience.
Yeah, no, I agree
on what Lyle said.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Lyle said. I mean, the entire ecosystem is you're paid for taking out organs, right? That's who makes the most money in healthcare, and essentially it's a fee for service world. And we're pushing physicians and providers really to an RVU model where the more you work, the more you get. And clearly today, like it or not, you actually get paid more RVUs. You collect more RVUs to seeing a person in person.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're collecting points, you're going to try to drive the most points, and you're going to go away from technologies that may be more efficient, more easier for patients. Look, I think healthcare is on the cusp of exponential transformation. Generative AI is poised to revolutionize the industry, regardless of the reimbursement issue. We're going to be able to streamline processes, enhance patient experiences, and unlock unprecedented insights in care delivery. I think the reality is this time next year, we're going to be talking about how Lyle's using generative AI in his practice, right? It's a no-brainer to use a platform for telemedicine that's on the same EMR as you. You get that full same delivery and that experience that patients desire. I don't want to have 12 different apps to buy an airline ticket and then to get onto an airline and then to land. I want one platform. So I understand Lyle's point and what he's trying to do completely makes sense. But the reality is you're still asking Lyle and his physicians to deliver care. And that's hard. And you're trying to make them do it on a telehealth platform. I love telehealth. That's why I'm here, part of the board. But I'll say that the reality is we need more with less clinicians. We need more. We need to help our nurses and our physicians deliver on more. But we don't want them to do it. We don't want it on their backs. We want to make the transition and the workload less. And so generative AI, I think, is really the key. We're seeing the early stages of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it's still 1.0. Yeah.
Right? Transcription and dictation, and even just the automation of answering questions or delivering just key things that patients have outside of their healthcare delivery. But let's start providing individual generative AI agents for each patient, and then wrap it around Lyle's team and the EMR, and then the entire care delivery service. We don't need to worry about licensing. We don't need to worry necessarily about reimbursement. When we start bringing these AI agents in and we empower them with the physicians, with the nurses, then we start to bring these insights in that we've never seen before.
But we're seeing it as point solutions, Craig. You know, I'm seeing lots of things going on in making a physician more productive by giving them summaries of the EHR and doing triage on patients before they get in and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Is anybody sitting there thinking about the entire? Because I will tell you, I know you guys are all in it. I'm one of the consumers of this stuff. And as a consumer, healthcare, the experience is so bad. I'm still filling out paper sheets and giving you consent to my data every time I go to see my GP. Right. So it is broken completely. Is anybody, Greg, are you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's our big challenge in the US in particular is fragmentation, right? And it relates directly to telehealth as well. I mean, if you look at who has addressed the scalability issue in telehealth in the US, it's Kaiser, who is in a more capitated model where, you know, while providers are still paid for activities, you could argue they're also, you know, at the system level, they're definitely saying, hey, let's get a million people onto a remote monitoring platform, not a few thousand or 10,000, right? Which seems to be the cap in almost every other organization because they're depending on that reimbursement versus looking at the cost of care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's interesting as we talk, one of the things that comes to mind, a lot of what we are talking about, including what Chaim just said, was, you know, is it going to happen first outside the US and maybe not even in Western Europe, where we tend to think, but in a more developing country where you can see more experimentation, more analytics to the individual, right? For self-care and managing chronic conditions, you know, will we see some of those things that apply the technology in more innovative ways in a less regulated environment, let's be honest, where, you know, you can do more and try more. Maybe that's where it'll happen. Otherwise, you know, it's going to take a long time for us to get to a more capitated care, you know, a lot more consolidation, which we all say we hate. But I can tell you, I was a Kaiser member. I'm now Aetna and Cigna in the last 3 years. And I would take Kaiser any day as a consumer, as that single platform.
It's completely integrated.
You know, ability, integrated, and, you know, less care about who sees who, more care about who do you want to see or what do you want to do, what's convenient for the consumer.
I'll give you an example of what I saw in China earlier this year. But Bill, you've been nodding away there.
Greg brought up a lot of great points, and it's interesting, you know, if you look at Kaiser, where, as Lyle pointed out, you know, reimbursement is a challenge in a lot of organizations. Mostly the reimbursement is aligned there for the things that we're talking about, and they're still struggling with workflow. So, you know, that is where I would say that the workflow does continue to show itself. I think the point about global innovation is a really important one. We just actually completed a survey be coming out in the first week of November that shows the attitudes for generative AI are more advanced globally than they are in the US. And I think there's a couple reasons for that, you know, and I would hypothesize along the lines of what Greg was talking about. One, I don't even know if it's regulations as much as, again, I'll go back to more alignment with, you have a single payer system, generally speaking, in the rest of the world that tends to align with more population health initiatives, with more holistic care models. But second, I think there are more open platforms. So I think we have, you know, this kind of blessing and a curse with a dominant platform in the US that is causing people to wait for innovation. I think that a lot of times we'll talk to folks and say, well, I'm just going to wait for my application vendor to fix it. I'm just going to wait for this EMR to fix it. And the rest of the world is going forward. And they're saying, no, I can do this with APIs and other platforms, and I'm going to innovate because generative AI to what Shine was talking about, is so much more accessible. It's so much easier to use. It's so much different of a technology than people are used to. So we do see the rest of the world going faster in generative AI than we're going in the US, in healthcare at least, in terms of adoption.
I've seen in China, as I said, the complete integration. They live on WeChat, which is the main platform that they use, for everything: shopping, taxis, metro, the lot. You create your appointment there. A bot triages you, Cheyenne. So it basically says, "Why do you want to see whatever?" A bot then tells you, "Maybe you don't want to need to see a doctor. Go see this pharmacist, and I've organized something for you." And then they've connected it up. So I went to a village and there's a pod. A fingerprint opens the pod. You go in, you sit down, chatbot comes up. Why are you here? Then it connects you to telehealth. And then there's a pharmacy connected to the pod that dispenses your medication. And you just pop it out, just like you're getting a can of soda from a soda machine, and you walk off with it. They've completely changed and reimagined it because they've had the same issue, which is they don't have as many doctors to
Access,
take care of everybody, right? So they're using bots and AI and connectivity and remote pods and all sorts of varieties of experimentation to change the way they deliver care. Sarah, you're smiling away over there. Do you think that will happen here?
I mean, unlikely, right? There would have to be, for us in the US to get to one seamless platform, I mean, is just unlikely, right? And it comes down to how our healthcare system works in general. It would need a major overhaul that I don't see happening. And there is a benefit to some of the competitive nature that we have, right? Some of the advancements that we've done in telehealth and in other areas of virtual care has been because there's competition in the space. And there's a lot of innovation that happens from that competition. So unless we have major like governmental and policy changes that pushes us in that space, I don't know if I see that happen.
Or unless somebody says, hey, the rural healthcare is falling apart, creating
And
a
that's one thing
vacuum
we
that
need to
I could
fix.
fill, right? That you could take Cheyenne's model, you could plop it into the rural US, and maybe it provides a lot of the benefit that we're losing as hospitals close in those environments. And
I think there is.
politicians are going to address this at some point because their constituents
That's
are
very
losing
true.
their healthcare.
I want to just address Bill's point, right? I think the politicians are now involved, right? They're now, the legal system has to now weigh down on this
But
vendor.
isn't the bill expiring? Isn't the flexibility bill expiring at the end of the year? Or are
No,
they
no, no.
still
What I'm referring
negotiating?
to is this one vendor that we don't want to mention.
Oh, I see. I see. Lyle, it's Lyle's best friend, apparently.
Look, you can't control the innovation and the adoption and the pace of what people want to do, right? That's a challenge. And it's almost overpowering in terms of third-party vendors trying to develop new tools that are going to help care, make it easier, help our patients, help our clinicians. I think that's it is a rate-limiting step at this point.
Let's do we think from a policy perspective anything will change? We're seeing value-based care finally taking off. I'm seeing, I've seen in some places north of 50%. Do you think the politicians will catch up on all of this stuff, or is it still going to be a, continue pressuring them until
I
they
don't think
change,
that's
right?
going to be the solution, at
No.
least.
Okay. I
Yeah, I
think.
mean, they seem to be behind the curve and afraid. The Gen AI is more of the fear factor than the solution, right, for the politicians. I think one group we haven't mentioned at all, who should be holding some of the answers and paying some of the bills, are the payers, right?
Payers.
We're because in the end, they're the ones who benefit. Providers don't necessarily benefit from capitated care. Payers do. And they should be, pushing telehealth for efficiency, cost reasons, and figuring out how to work with providers to support them. But we don't see that very often. They're
You and I
starting
are
their own
both on,
telehealth offerings.
yeah, Greg, you and I are both on Aetna. I don't think I've ever used the Aetna telehealth app, ever. They keep sending me emails about it. Right? Sarah's laughing away over there. Have you
This
used
it
it?
is it people still traditionally go and trust their doctors. Now, not everyone necessarily has a doctor, so payers have been sponsoring telehealth for the past decade, two decades in many ways. It's been important, but the vast majority of telehealth is now done through health systems.
Yeah.
Pre-COVID, it was there probably 5 to 10 million visits a year. And that was traditionally done through the third-party telehealth 1.0 vendors sponsored by payers. Post-COVID, it is couple 100, 200 million visits a year, the vast majority, 90% of that being done through telehealth
But
systems,
is that
through
also
health
because we don't
systems.
segment our patients, right?
Yeah, probably, right?
Older patients, people who are sick, they're going to want to go to see their doc. But younger people who are time constrained, only screening to say, what is this? I feel sick, but most of the time I'm healthy. They don't care, right? I mean, that's the thing. We don't segment
Yeah,
them, but they
the good
care.
news is patients are actually pretty good at understanding what's a commodity and what's not.
Yeah,
And the
that's
issue is
true.
whether or not they want to get that through anybody or through health systems. I'm a health system guy, right? So this is my argument to health systems. You better have something or else they're going to go somewhere else.
Yeah,
And if
that's
you
true.
can't offer, a quick, easy, convenient online visit for routine stuff, they will go somewhere else.
It's
But
already
you have the
starting.
opportunity to capture it.
They
And
already are. They
if
already are.
payers are paying for it, which is what's happening, that's a fundamental difference. So the only reason I started another telehealth company, I never would have done it except for the fact that because of COVID, payers are paying for it. Right now, everything looks like that will continue. I would not be shocked if they lower, how
Yeah.
much they pay for
Yeah,
virtual care,
completely.
but I believe they'll still pay for it because it's so well aligned with patients
Yeah.
getting care easier, quicker, avoiding the ER, which is aligned, obviously. And but health systems need to rise up, and whether they do it, using Epic's tools, bringing in other tools, et cetera, that's what the market gets to decide, and how easy, fast, cheap is it to do. I can tell you health systems right now are, they're strapped for care time. Anything that involves any significant integration is very, very difficult. Patients, meanwhile, they just want convenient care for routine stuff. Yeah, it can be delivered by anybody, any way. The more complex it is, the more they want their doctor or
Yeah,
a
that's right.
doctor in the
I
health
think that's
system.
exactly
And
right.
it's fair that they actually, we did a recent survey, where 75% of patients said that they want the option of some level for virtual care. And one of the reasons, the obvious reasons, convenience, they don't want to go in somewhere where there's a bunch of sick people, right? But one of the things we're starting to ask now is 25% of them said they wanted it because they don't want to bother their doctor. Patients get the sense that for routine stuff, their doctors are really important
Because they're
and
crazy
they don't
busy as
want,
well, right?
and they're very busy and they don't want to bother them with mild routine stuff that they know can be easily done by someone.
Guys, I'm cognizant of the time, so I'm going to go to each one of you, and please try and keep it for a minute because we'll try and end at 10 o'clock. And Lyle, while you're speaking, so very quickly, this is about the next generation. Next 18 months, what do you think? What do you think is going to be amazing from a telehealth or a virtual care
Well,
perspective?
what's typical in healthcare, things don't change quickly. I think we're
That's
going
why I
to
said the
see
next 18
more sense of
months.
AI. I think we'll see more automation at the front end, AI,
Okay.
et cetera, helping, not doing the visits, but certainly prepping the visits. That waiting room experience happening. And my hope is that we'll also see it more deeply integrated into health systems, more adoption of being able to accept and provide virtual care in a team-based format.
Bill, what do you reckon?
I think that we're going to see amazing advances with generative AI. And I think if we think of innovation cycles as being 7 years in length, and that they create a parabolic exponential increase, acceleration of innovation, we're just at the end of, by most estimations, the seventh year of Gen AI's existence. And so we're going to really start to see acceleration. I think that we're going to see the adjudication of knowledge, elevation of knowledge, being able
Interesting.
to decrease abrasion between plan and provider, because we're going to have immediate agreement on what is a covered and not covered service, because we're going to have Gen AI helping us. And I'm going to agree with Lyle that we're also going to have virtual teammates that are going to be deployed en masse, that are going to really bring joy back to our clinical workforce because they're going to have those tedious tasks removed for them.
Thank you. Sarah, go over to you. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, agree with Bill and Lyle so far. I mean, AI, right? Gen AI is here. And it's going to continue to elevate in this space. I also think that we're going to see more adoption. We have to adopt, especially in rural America. There has to be further adoption. I think that's likely to happen. And then I think the other piece is having more virtual kind of staffing agencies, so to speak, right?
Interesting.
Providing virtual care, you know, as a service to healthcare institutions. So that's my take.
Greg?
Yeah, I think one of the things we'll see is the addressing of the scalability issue, because I think, Gen AI enables that somewhat, right? It enables us to create and leverage some scale. And then we have, I think you might have been referring to the expiration of the hospital at home waiver system and maybe the extension for, say, 5 years instead of 2 years.
2 years,
And
yeah.
if they go to a, something 3, 4, 5 year extension, now organization can really say, how do I scale this up? How do I, raise the bar of what I'm doing? So I think the scalability question is a key one for telehealth for the last 20 years that we have never quite overcome. And I think we'll start to see that happen because of technology, because of policy, and because of the business case.
Sounds like we may be at the tipping point. You're right, Greg. Cheyenne, last word from you, sir.
Yeah, so unfortunately, I don't anticipate any federal improvements when it comes to medical. That's a big barrier. The medical state licensing is just a significant toll for physicians. The nurses have done a great job on the compact. Kudos to them, but just no federal improvement there. I think, unfortunately, there's not going to be a significant reimbursement for telehealth, which is, we pointed out earlier, as a barrier. I do see virtual nursing continue to rise. Lyle and I have been practicing virtual medicine for a long time. I think it's now in the hands of the nurses to expand. I think you're seeing that in the inpatient side. I think you're going to continue to see nurses reaching out to post-discharge patients, provided that they have bandwidth, right? The challenges with nurses is their bandwidth is tapped. We're asking the nurses to do way too much at this point. The wearables, right? There's now band-aids that can measure my heart rate, right? You're going to see that technology explode. And that's going to open up the hospital in the home, virtual telemedicine at home, right? And then, of course, not to be forgotten is generative AI. It's transformative. We're seeing physicians, nurses, documentation becoming more efficient. Some of the routine tasks are becoming eliminated by artificial intelligence. That's the elementary level of artificial intelligence, I would say. The Gen AI space is going to just transform healthcare. How we can make it affordable is going to be very important to Lyle's point. How we're going to be able to do an easy switch to bring it in to your vendor, your EMR. That's going to be, and it has to coincide with the workflow that physicians are practicing. Irregardless of the value-based care or the fee-for-service that we're in, it has to fit the swim lane that we're all in.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for the conversation today. I learned a lot. Maybe I think the last thing I'd say is maybe we do need to rebrand this whole thing into virtual care as opposed to telehealth. And with that, I thank each and every one of you for a fantastic conversation. Have a great day, everyone.
Thanks.